Welcome to the latest podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners e-learning team. Today's podcast is looking at functional GI disorders in paediatrics.
I'm Dr. Emma Nash, GP and e-learning fellow at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Peter Gillett, who is a consultant paediatric gastroenterologist in Edinburgh. Peter's here to discuss the most common paediatric GI issues GPs may encounter, some tips on recognising significant pathology, and an overview of functional GI disorders in children. Thank you for joining us today, Peter.
You're very welcome, Emma. Thanks very much. Nice to be here, and hopefully I can be of some help today.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. So as GPs, we've all had many consultations with parents, or sometimes the young person themselves, about gastrointestinal issues. Although we manage a lot of it in primary care, what sort of things do you frequently get referred through? And is there anything different or additional that we could be doing to manage these patients ourselves?
Yeah, I think it's a very big issue for paediatric secondary care too, Emma. We get all sorts of functional abdominal symptoms referred, and they probably overall make up a large majority of the cases that we see as consultations. When we look at the literature, it suggests that around 25% of cases that we see in secondary care are actually functional pain type conditions. And those would be things like classical IBS symptoms, whether that's diarrhea or constipation, classic abdominal migraine, or abdominal pain with kids who have headaches as well, or travel sickness. I think that nausea is a huge issue these days. We get lots of kids and young people referred up with that. And then we have things like regurgitant reflux or functional acid reflux problems that we would call non-erosive reflux disease or functional dyspeptic symptoms. Other conditions that we see are kids that or young people that have got cyclical vomiting. And of course, a large number of patients with chronic functional constipation, where about 90% of those patients actually do not have a specific alternative underlying cause other than a gut motility problem. So the list is really almost endless.
You mentioned that we get patients who've got combinations of upper and lower symptoms, so it can be quite complex.
Yeah, I think one of the things clearly is that patients don't often read the textbook and want to throw you curveballs. So, for example, it's very common for us to see nausea and abdominal pain and altered bowel habit that go together, or you know, the kids and young people who have headaches as well as nausea and gut-related issues, and it's sometimes quite difficult to tease it all out. They're not always totally straightforward, and I think probably become a more complex kind of web almost to unpick.
We often get letters back stating that the diagnosis is, as you've mentioned, functional constipation or functional nausea. But what's actually meant when conditions are described as functional? And can you give us an idea of the range of functional GI conditions that exist in paediatrics?
Yeah, I think when we look at the newer Rome 4 criteria, that these are obviously a set of criteria that you may have heard about, but also might discuss with adult colleagues, a set of criteria so that, to be honest, where research actually is the focus, and so that people studying functional gut disorders have the same definitions and are essentially talking from the same page. The new criteria would define functional disorders as disorders of gut-brain function. And I think that's actually a very good concept. I think it's much clearer than some of the previous criteria. And we're all now using that as a new form of description. And I think it's a very good starting point for when you're trying to explain functional GI conditions in the clinic to families and children and young people. I think that it's a complex set of almost the talking of the brain and the bowel together And I think that actually allows us to conceptualize for the families, which it's sometimes seen as quite an abstract discussion. I think it's really important, actually, and you've obviously said that you get letters back stating that someone has a functional disorder. I think it's very important in the clinic or in any consultation to make a positive diagnosis and say, actually, this is what I think you are. So, for example, I think you have abdominal migraine, and here are the key things that we're going to do to move forward with your management.
That's really helpful. I mean, if you're talking about 25% or so of the population that you see having functional disorders, is there any reason why some children might develop these conditions? For example, you know, when we look at the holistic picture, are there any biopsycho or social aspects to a child that might be useful to identify when we're trying to put the diagnosis together?
I think these are really good points, Emma. It's not just about a pain issue. There's so much more to it. I think that the vast majority of children and young people that have functional gut disorders will have some degree of family history. That might be outlined in your history taking, where, you know, the mum or dad might have a migraine type issue or travel sickness. That's one of my favourite questions to ask, because it gives you a kind of almost a hook into giving the formulation. It's very clear that children and young people with particularly IBS or dyspeptic acid related issues do have a family history. And certainly for acid related disorders, there's some evidence that there is a specific genetic element to their predisposition. So I think, in short, an answer to your question would be there is often a family history. I think often families might not have the penny drop, and you might be the person that facilitates that by your wider history taking. The other aspects, and you've mentioned biopsychosocial, you know, family debt, people who have died in the family or loss of a pet. There are lots of important things that you need to potentially ask about. That's sometimes not very easy to do at the beginning of a consultation. And often I leave those types of questions towards the end, after I've given the formulation of the functional gut problem and the plan moving forward. I think particularly asking children and young people a little bit about themselves is often a good icebreaker at the beginning. You know, what school are you at? What's your favourite subject? What do you think you'll do when you're a bit older? And try to gain the confidence in what might be quite a difficult consultation, particularly if someone's been missing school or there have been other issues, for example, weight-related issues or anxiety issues in the past. I think it's a very tricky consultation sometimes, because you don't have a lot of time. Clearly, in secondary care, I have more time than you would have. But in fact, 30 minutes in my clinic goes very, very quickly. And there's a reason not to rush anything. When I'm taking a history, I often will decide early on whether I need to get that family back to chat further. But I think it's really important in that first consultation to sow the seeds of the functional GI issues and try to bring in some of the family elements to it that might help you almost sell your formulation.
It's really interesting that you have said that you leave the more kind of psychosocial bits to the end of the consultation, where you've built up confidence with them. And I think that kind of relates to GPs. So, you know, we, aside from wanting to achieve successful treatment for the patient, referrals are also often made for the purpose of excluding significant pathology first. And what sort of things do GPs need to be most mindful of? And what approach would you recommend primary care takes with this?
Thanks. Again, that's a really good question. When I was doing my training quite a while ago, obviously in paediatrics, we were told that we didn't want to over-medicalise patients who had functional issues. But I think we're living in a very different world now. We often have families who have been looking on the internet and have had helpful advice from friends, and the seeds have already been sown about significant, I don't really like the word, but people use it, or organic conditions. I think it's really important for a consultation to be based around what the family are worried about, and particularly what the child or young person are worried about, and give them an opportunity to ask any questions and actually bring out what they think they're actually worried about and what's going on. But I think a lot of families will feel shortchanged if they don't get some form of investigation. And I think there are a finite number of tests that can be done at the very beginning, obviously tailored to the symptoms that a specific patient has. But in fact, some of the tests that are really helpful to do as a line drawer are very straightforward, and I think the majority could be done in primary care. And in fact, it might be a good idea to do them up front rather than refer in. So the things I would be thinking about would be saying to a family, I think that this is a functional gut disorder. Let's say we're talking about IBS with diarrhea as an example. I would give the formulation and then I would say, listen, I'm going to make sure that we've excluded all the important things. And I know from our discussion that you've had specific worries, but if you haven't had any, here are the things I think we should exclude. And the common exclusions for abdominal pain type problems would be thinking about doing a Helicobacter antigen if there are specific upper GI issues. Sometimes kids actually having Helicobacter might actually have just recurrent abdominal pain and not classic dyspepsia. So that's something to bear in mind. Doing a calprotectin in particular children who have got altered bowel habit with this, is it inflammatory bowel disease or is it IBS with diarrhea, I think is a really helpful thing to do. And I think calprotectin, if you're able to do it, is probably one of the more discriminating tests that we have available to all of us. Those individuals under the age of 5, you would need to think very carefully about whether you did that test or not, as IBD is clearly less common. And the normal range for calprotectin is a little bit different the younger you are. In fact, higher levels seem to be the norm. I think doing some basic blood tests and to look at conditions like celiac disease that can present with constipation or abdominal pain or fatigue or nausea or vomiting or altered bowel habit with constipation or loose stools or a mixture of the two, they're probably the most discriminating tests. I think one of the other tests that might be helpful, and again, it would be depending on the symptoms that the family were bringing to you, would be to do an ultrasound. Although I think the pickup rate on ultrasound for things like hepatobiliary problems and gallstones, particularly in the childhood age group, it is not a very high pickup. But again, it might be helpful in the overall reassurance angle that we might all want to use. Although clearly doing tests is sometimes a double-edged sword, as you know.
Touched on celiac disease and mentioned that there were a sort of myriad of symptoms that could be related. Is the approach to diagnosis the same in children as it is in adults? And, you know, are there features that are more common in children that we should look out for?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. Celiac disease is probably my kind of favourite condition. There's a lot of it about, and organisations like Celiac UK have very, very helpful information for GPs and secondary care and obviously families about symptoms. Celiac disease has been described by one kind of leader in paediatric GI, Alessio Fasano, as a clinical chameleon. And I think that's a really good thing to remember. Any sort of symptomatology can be a presenting factor. We see particularly, obviously, young children who are exposed to gluten and perhaps in the second year of life over the age of 1 might present with poor growth or vomiting or altered bowel habit that progresses. Toddlers particularly seem to present classically with grumpiness or altered mood, sometimes kind of behavioral regression and even a regression in development. For children in particular, I think older children and young people will present in very, very similar ways to adults. The intestinal symptoms seem to be less with an older presentation, but the classic IBS presentation that people are advised to check for celiac disease by organisations like NICE still apply. Constipation, perhaps delayed puberty, we see now and again, or just tiredness, actually, or an iron deficiency anemia that's picked up on bloods because someone has come in with fatigue. These are important things to think about. And I think a lot of the time, they are very, very similar symptoms to adults, but clearly with that growth aspect that we see in children and perhaps a lack of growth or development either into toddlerhood or into the pubertal age. These are key times to have a pretty low bar to do the test. I think it's really important for us to think about specific at-risk groups. And in fact, my experience is that many families will come either to secondary care or primary care when they've identified that there might be a risk factor within the family, or if we're talking about specific conditions that that child or young person might have. I think for some of the at-risk conditions like type 1 diabetes or autoimmune thyroid issues, or children and young people who have specific syndromes like Down syndrome or Turner syndrome or Williams syndrome, I think that secondary care will probably be on it from that point of view. If you feel that those individuals haven't been checked out, it is something definitely to consider in primary care. I think the biggest group that we potentially miss out on screening would be the first degree family members. We, in the clinic that I do with my dietitian, we're very keen to make families aware when we get a new patient diagnosed that they have, as a family, around a 10% lifetime risk of the condition if there is one family member diagnosed. The biggest risk where there is a family history is when there are two first degree family members. And in fact, the biggest risk, third part of the risk, is if you're female. So the highest risk patients would appear to be first degree family members where there's a family history already, and if you're female. And I think we should all be very cognizant of that, because we are tasked, in inverted commas, by organisations to try to pick up celiac disease more, because we're told that around 1 in 100 people in the United Kingdom, if you screen the population, would have the condition, but we probably pick up about a third of those. And it may be from the at-risk groups like first degree relatives that we're not quite finding or case finding as well as we should. And certainly if a family come to you, I think as a GP, with a worry that there's a family history, even I guess if there's an aunt or a cousin or grandparent, I think there probably should be a relatively low bar to think about offering the test.
Thank you so much, Peter. That's really given us an overview of GI disorders in children in an absolute nutshell. It's brilliant. Thank you. But I think that's all we've got time for today. So really a huge thank you to Peter for joining us to discuss paediatric GI disorders. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website to find others on a variety of subjects. Goodbye.